Hey, please, Court. I'm Darrell Cook, Jr.
You're going to speak up. Some of them are hard here.
I'm Darrell Cook, Jr., representing the petition in this case, filed in fact. Mr. Duncan Wilson, who is counsel and director on this case, is ill and unable to attend. This is a deal for an order denying a bill of review. The bill of review is the draft set aside as a board settlement. This is what might be characterized as a post-answer default judgment. And the trial court's decision was based entirely upon the pleadings and affidavits presented at a Baker v. Goldsmith hearing. The fact situation is that the parties, at least according to our petitioner, the parties were married in 1975. In 1981, they separated briefly. And in August of 1981, our client filed a standard no-fault divorce petition in which she asked for custody of their two small children. stated that there was probably going to be a property settlement agreement and asked the court to divide the property accordingly. Shortly after Ms. Beck filed this petition, she apparently became reconciled with Mr. Beck. And that was the last that happened on that petition until early 1984. In the meantime, the Becks had apparently come to the conclusion that the reconciliation simply was not going to take. And according to Violet Beck, she had reached an agreement with Mr. Beck by which he was to file for divorce. They were to receive joint conservatorship of the children. And an agreement which is not in evidence regarding the disposition of their property was to be incorporated in this new divorce. On January of 1984, instead of filing the divorce, the new divorce action, Merle Beck filed a cross petition in 1981. In which he asked for sole managing conservatorship of the children, temporary child support, and for the court to divide the property, make no mention of any property agreement or anything of that nature. Now, at that time, Ms. Beck had moved from Bastrop, where this case originated, to Austin. Merle Beck's cross petition was drawn up in basically in the same form as an ordinary divorce petition. Included an Austin address for service. Apparently no service of citation was ever attempted. However, also apparently, a Mrs. Rogers, who'd been Ms. Beck's attorney back in 1981, received a copy of the cross petition. And in March of 1984, she filed a motion to withdraw. And she filed that on March 7th, and apparently an order permitting the withdrawal was signed the same day. In her motion, she stated first that she had never been paid by Mrs. Beck, and second that she had had no contact with her since the filing of the petition. The upshot of all of this, I believe she at the same time received, Ms. Rogers, that is, had received notice of the trial setting on April 18th. The upshot of all this was that Mrs. Beck never received notice of the trial set. She had been in daily or weekly contact with Mr. Beck regarding, basically regarding the children, all the way up to April 18th, which was the trial set. And in fact, two or three times that week of April 18th, he had never mentioned to her, even that the cross petition had been filed, much less if there was a trial setting in the case. She did not, in fact, learn that the trial had taken place until she received notice from the clerk 2 weeks after the divorce decree had been signed by Judge, I believe Judge Blackman. Now, at the trial on April 18th, the court, in effect, granted Mr. Beck to respond to everything that he asked for, made him sole managing conservator of the children, ordered Mrs. Beck to pay temporary child support, which never became an issue in this case, and divided the property of the parties by awarding Mr. Beck the party's house and all other property of which he was in possession, and giving Mrs. Beck all of her property. The effect of this property division, as contained in our sworn bill of review petition, was that Mr. Beck got around $178,000 worth of property. Mrs. Beck got around $2,000. I think she, in fact, got an old car and maybe the clothes on her back. The divorce decree was signed on May 16th of that year, setting forth these things. Around about the 30th of that month, Mrs. Beck received notice from the clerk by mail. She immediately contacted another attorney, not Mrs. Rogers, an Austin attorney named Terry Storr. He filed a motion for a new trial for her on June 7th. And there is a notation on the docket sheet, I believe from that date, in which Judge Blackie reset the case. It doesn't say for what, for July 25th. Apparently when Mr. Storr filed his motion for a new trial, he approached Judge Blackie either in chambers or in corridor of the courthouse, something of that nature there in Bastrop, explained what the problem was about Violet Beck never having received notice of the trial in this case. And apparently Judge Black orally agreed to grant the motion for a new trial. Now, Mr. Stork got back to his office in Austin and mailed to Mr. Jenkins, who, there was nothing in the record to indicate whether Mr. Jenkins was present at this conversation with Judge Blackie or not, a letter in the record in our supplementary transcript from Mr. Stork and Mr. Jenkins enclosed a proposed order for on the motion for a new trial and asked Mr. Jenkins to look it over and approve it and present it to Judge Blackie.
Counsel, let me
move
you along a little bit to my concern. So the order wasn't signed, it was overruled as a motion of law, and you filed a bill of review and you had a hearing on it. What did the trial court consider at the bill of review hearing?
The trial court considered, you mean what is on the record?
Yes.
They considered the petition. They considered the affidavit of Mr. Stork and the the attachments to that, which were the letters from Mr. Stork to Mr. Jenkins, and I believe a letter from Mr. Jenkins to Mr. Stork. And it's not clear, it was certainly available at the time, but it's not clear whether or not the court also considered Mrs. Beck's answers to interrogatories which were propounded.
You say it was a Baker versus Goldsmith hearing. Did the trial court consider all three elements of the bill of review or just the meritorious defense of them?
Well, it's a little hard to tell. I believe the trial court did consider, certainly considered the question of meritorious defense. He apparently also considered the question of whether or not Mrs. Beck and Mr. Stork had been negligent in allowing the motion for new trial to be overruled by operation of law. He also considered and reserved for judgment the question of whether or not the failure to file an application for writ of error to the Court of Civil Appeals was a prerequisite for the filing of the bill of review. And that is, at least in our opinion, looking from the record, rather skimpy record of that hearing, when the court ruled that Ms. Beck had failed to show a meritorious defense, it was on the basis that the failure to file a writ of error operated as a bar of the sort contemplated by Baker v. Goldsmith. It has been our contention all along that her failure to file a writ of error is just one of the two elements. Is the third element, that is, it goes to whether or not she was negligent or not diligent, rather than the question of whether it constitutes a part of the meritorious defense.
What's wrong with considering the third element at the hearing?
Nothing would be wrong with considering that hearing. The question is, if there was a meritorious defense, the standard there is a question of prima facie evidence. If it's one of the second or third prongs, the fraud or the lack of negligence prong, it seems to us that the standard should simply be that you should have to make a showing that in Baker v. Goldsmith refers talking about the defense. That is where the prima facie showing element comes in. We're talking about the second and third elements of the Baker v. Goldsmith, prima facie evidence does not come in there.
Why didn't you have a full opportunity to present whatever you wanted to say on the second and third elements of this hearing?
Well, primarily, Your Honor, because the allegations that we made regarding those things. Our petition for bill of review stuck pretty much to factual allegations. We did not, for instance, I believe, and I could be wrong about this, but we did not say, no, we're not negligent. And yes, we were diligent. We said, this is what we did. This is how things happened. Rather than making these conclusory allegations. Those are precisely the kinds of things that, in our view, once they are raised at all in any kind of a reasonable manner, which we have done, are going to be up to the trier of fact at the regular trial of the bill of review, provided we get past the Baker v. Goldsmith standard. Now,
well, why wasn't this a regular trial? What is there in the record to indicate that This was not a regular trial. It was simply preceded by agreement on the papers that had been filed and the argument of counsel, and the court decided it when it was over.
Well, if you look at the court going all the way through, it's talking about, you know, we will give her a trial. She should have a chance to do this. I'm inclined to do this unless, to give her a trial unless I can do otherwise. It's apparent, I don't believe, for instance, that Ms. Beck was present at this. I don't believe, if you read that statement of fact, it's apparent that nobody, neither the judge nor Mr., I don't know whether it's Mr. Sanderson or Mr. Jenkins, nor Mr. Wilson, intended this to be anything but here.
Well, I can't tell one way or the other.
Was there oral testimony taken at the hearing?
There was no oral testimony taken, no. There was no attempt to offer any. It was apparent also the Judge Dowsley, I believe, made the statement that he'd never done one of these in a divorce case before. But it seems to me apparent that no one was trying to make a trial as such. The only order of business was to determine the prima facie thing, as is contemplated by Baker v. Goldsmith. The court does say in that case that you can go ahead and have the trial right then if you want to. But it certainly doesn't, mandate that. That wasn't judged on the record within the contemplation of anybody there. At the end of this very brief hearing, the judge asked for briefs on the specific point regarding the writ of error failure, and said, I want them in 2 weeks. He did not ask for anything substantial there. And that was it. Following which, of course, after he did receive the briefs, within about a week or two, he issued his order stating that a prima facie case had not been made. Now,
well, the parties could go in, present their case, get a ruling from the judge, and that'd be the end. But you claim that you just didn't mean to do that in this case.
They didn't mean to. I don't think anybody thought that was what was going on. I haven't seen any claim by the respondent here that that's what happened.
How long did the hearing last?
It's, I don't have the record right in front of me, Your Honor, but it's only about 15 or 20 pages long. Probably no more than 30 minutes, I would guess.
Was there any evidence introduced as to what would be in the best interest of the children?
No, although there was the only evidence that would go directly to that would have been the interrogatories propounded by respondents, to which Ms. Beck had answered those things, specifically several questions related to the best interest of the children.
Was there any discussion at this hearing of the value of the community property?
The only discussion there was Mr. Wilson, in effect, repeating what was in our sworn position for public review, saying that he thought that the split was approximately $2,000 to $178,000. That was it. Now, the court, in its ruling, simply stated that this case was dismissed for failure to state to make a prima facie defense. That was appealed to the Court of Appeals here in Austin. The Austin Court of Appeals got a long, rather confusing opinion. As best we can judge, the point on which they intended to be held, the point which they intended to be taken as the turning point of the case is a failure to file a motion for writ of error following the discovery that their motion for new trial had been overruled by operation of law. Now, they made that discovery in early September of 1984. The time for filing the writ of error ran out on November 16th of that year. I would point out here, and I don't believe it has been brought up before, that under the decisions of this court, application for writ of error only is to address itself to matters appearing on the record. And the record in the original case there is totally devoid of anything which would constitute reversible error. You've got a petition filed, you've got an answer filed, you have a statement in the docket sheet to the effect that notice was given, which of course we disagree with, but it's right there on the record. The pleadings and the decree are all in perfectly valid form. There is really nothing there to appeal on writ of error. Ms. Beck, to require her to file a motion, not a motion, but to file an appeal by way of writ of error in this case, would have been to require her to do something which would be totally pointless. There wasn't anything there on the record to appeal. And certainly under the decision of this court and the McEwen case, and in, I believe it's Pace versus Davis Brothers Publishing, in both of those cases, the court specifically states that that's all there is on red there. Is error on the face of the record, and there wasn't any. And to throw this case out, as was done because of that, or as the Court of Appeals wanted to do, simply say the bill of review isn't available, even when you're, because you didn't do something which would have been pointless to do. And we don't think the law requires that. As I said, we further feel that our excuse for not filing the writ of error, as set forth in the sworn pleadings, which was that Mrs. Beck was totally impoverished by this judgment. She had no money to hire an attorney. At the same time, the judgment, which had given her husband basically power over the children. Her husband had allowed her to visit them, had allowed them in fact to live with her. And she was in a state at that point where I believe she was afraid that if she did anything, such as filing an application for writ of error, her husband had the legal right to take those children back. Add to that, the trial court, over experience, Mrs. Beck and Mr. Beck were at that time in counseling with a father, Dr. Teal, I believe, and remained in counseling for some time after the time for filing the writ of error had passed. She alleges in here that as soon as that time for filing the writ of error had passed, that at that point, Mr. Beck then took the children back. He stopped apparently making noises about maybe she could have more of the property than the divorce decree entitled.
Thank you, counsel. With your argument, respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Forrest Anderson III will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court, once again, I'm Forrest Anderson. I'm believe I can get some time back to court. I don't have a great deal to say that would not be in my brief, so I'm going to make my presentation fairly quick unless there are some more questions. Our position in this case is basically that petitioner simply failed under Baker v. Goldsmith both to plead and to prove their case. In the petition, there's already been some questions regarding the hearing that took place. Basically, that was a hearing pursuant to Baker v. Goldsmith, which requires that there be a pretrial hearing to show a prima facie of proof before a bill of review goes forward. Baker v. Goldsmith also says that the petition, which is filed by the bill of review petitioner, must state factually and with particularity facts that the judgment was rendered as a result of fraud, accident, or mistake of the opposing party, and unmixed with the petitioner's own negligence. And of course, the petition must be sworn to document these facts. It goes on to say that a prima facie meritorious defense cannot be made unless the petitioner himself or herself can show that their defense is not barred as a matter of law. And I think I know what the Court of Appeals decided, because of course their opinion is in writing, and I think also the trial court decided the same thing, that the appellant in this case, petitioner in this case, simply failed to both plead and prove these things at the Baker Goldsmith hearing. And incidentally, that hearing was, I guess, could be described more in the sense of a summary judgment hearing. Both parties, I was present for the respondent, and of course, petitioner's attorney was present, and we both asked the court to simply consider the pleadings, the sworn pleadings, as evidence, uncontroverted, at least at that hearing, and also the affidavits that were attached to that petition, and lastly, the sworn interrogatories that I had submitted to the petitioner to answer. And the court took all those things into consideration, and I feel made its decision based upon fact that the petitioner failed to show any type of meritorious defense, failed to show that anything was caused by the respondent in terms of fraud, accident, or mistake, and lastly, failed to show that she, the petitioner, was in any way diligent or non-negligent in her pursuit of this case.
You said this was in the nature of a summary judgment?
Yes, Your Honor.
I mean, isn't that what happened, that you were granted summary judgment without ever having filed a motion for summary judgment?
Basically, what I filed was entitled a motion to dismiss. I contemplated at length whether or not to file a simple summary judgment or whether or not to file a motion to dismiss. And I looked carefully at Baker v. Goldsmith and finally decided that there appeared to be enough structure in that case, because it does set forth step by step what type of procedures are to be followed. And after looking at Baker v. Goldsmith and looking at the types of hearings that the case required, I decided to go ahead and just entitle it a motion to dismiss. I could entitle it a motion for summary judgment for all that matters. I don't think for practical considerations for this board or for the board that we're making a difference what I call it, except for the 21-day notice of requirement or something of that nature. I still think Calvin for the hearing would be the same. Looking briefly at the petition, you see that the problem number one, which is a meritorious defense, was not met simply because the petitioner did not show how the property would have been divided any differently had she had been there. Secondly, it failed to show any facts giving any reason why the respondent would not have been awarded custody anyway. And lastly, and perhaps more importantly, she did not show why her cause of action under the bill of review would not have been barred as a matter of law because of her failure in pursuing her remedies in the appellate court. Looking at prong number two, whether or not anything was caused by the conduct of the party, the judge, both in the trial court and the judges at the Court of Appeals, both decided that simply the respondent did not in any way interfere with her management of her case. You have to remember that she was the petitioner. She was the one who filed the divorce action. My client really came in after the fact and filed a cross petition, which incidentally was served upon her attorney of record. there is, should be no doubt that she had notice of the case because of the fact that, again, served upon her attorney's record. Now, this goes into her negligence into the case because of the fact that she failed to cooperate, as the record shows, with her attorney, and after their initial visit, never even came back to visit with her attorney. Finally, we're talking about Ms. Kay Rogers. Finally, Ms. Rogers gave a motion to withdraw, but it wasn't until after Ms. Rogers was notified of the cross action and also, I believe, of the hearing date that her motion to withdraw from the case was granted. So she was attorney of record all that period of time.
Who were the children living with when she moved to Austin?
Dave, Your Honor, I'm sorry, I can't answer that question. I will not be turning the case. I do know that there were several attempts at reconciliation between the parties, and I think even if you read between the lines of the petitioner's bill of review, you'll see that those attempts were, I believe, very modified attempts. In the petition for bill of review, the petitioner, even before it was said, and I quote, responding, did not advise the petitioner that her attorney had withdrawn, as if the duty now is upon the respondent be giving legal advice to the petition. Both parties are represented by counsel. That, of course, is not something that would be respondent's responsibility. Now, the second act that I think would be clearly negligent on the part of the respondent is the action that was committed by her second attorney, Mr. Terry Starr, who did indeed try to get a motion for a new trial and filed the motion in a timely manner. There was some discussion evidently between the Mr. Jenkins, who was the respondent's attorney at the time, and her attorney, Mr. Stark, as to whether or not this motion would be granted. But the sum total of it is that Mr. Stark failed to get the motion or the order signed before the expiration date of the court's jurisdiction expired. In fact, if you look at Mr. Stark's own affidavit, it will show you that it was, in fact, Mr. Jenkins, the respondent's attorney at the time, who had advised Mr. Storr that the time had expired. He was not even keeping up with his own timetable. So clearly that would, I believe, constitute negligence on the part of the attorney at that point. And according to the Conrad versus Orlando, which is quoted in my recited in my brief, that negligence would be applied to the respondent. Now lastly, the third event of negligence on the part of the petitioner, of course, is her failure to file a writ of error. She had certainly plenty of time. Her claim now is that she was pauperized by the judgment. She claimed there was approximately $180,000 of community assets. And if this court at some point wants to carve out a pauper's exception to due diligence on the part of a bill of review petition, I think that's bona fide. However, I think the court should look carefully at what steps that pauperized person took before they decided to not pursue anything further legally. You'll see in her answer to an interrogatory, I believe it's number 21, when it was asked point blank what type of evidence, or what, I'm sorry, what type of efforts did she pursue in obtaining an attorney? There was none at all until she filed a bill of review. She was also praise of the fact of her appellate remedies evidently by Mr. Stork. However, once again, she did not show where she was not negligent. She did not pursue her diligence in that manner. She certainly could have found somebody. If there was $180,000 of community property at issue, somebody, I'm sure, would have been able to take the case.
Counsel, you're kind of trying the merits of the case. I was under the impression that what's at issue is whether or not the trial court was required to conduct a trial on the allegations of the bill of review, and that the trial court did not conduct such a trial. You characterized it yourself, I believe, as a motion to dismiss.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Why didn't the trial judge hear any evidence on these allegations made in the bill of review?
Well, because we were the Baker Goldsmith hearing that we were in under requires that there leave your prima facie showing at that hearing before there be any need for a further trial down the road, before the expense and the inconvenience to the parties and so forth takes place for an evidentiary hearing.
So you're essentially saying that there was no prima facie showing. That's the reason you're arguing the merits of this.
That's exactly true, Your Honor. And the reason why I feel like we can get into this third prong is that Baker versus Goldsmith once again said that a prima facie meritorious defense is where the petitioner shows a defense is not barred as a matter of law, and he is entitled to judgment if no evidence to the contrary is presented. And also in my brief, I cited at least two cases which have disposed of the bill of review in this type of manner and been upheld on appeal. One of them is the Kentucky's versus Texas Electric Service Company, founded 470 South West Second 387, and the other is the Hicks versus Armstrong, which is cited at 708 South West Second 890. Both of those are summary judgment cases where the courts of appeal have simply found that the bill of review petitioner did not sufficiently plead and did not sufficiently show in the pleadings, in other words, all three of these elements. In essence, if that were not the case, then it would be a matter of sending this case back down to the trial court. At this point, I would feel like, and if that were to happen, we'd simply file another motion for summary judgment requiring them to show some sort of proof on these elements. And I think if that were to be done, it would indeed be a waste of the judicial economy. And I think that's exactly what the pretrial hearing is supposed to accomplish in Baker versus Goldsmith. One last point that I do want to mention is the Peralta versus Medical, Peralta versus Hyatt Medical Center Incorporated case, cited by the Supreme Court of the United States, which is cited in the third point of error by the petitioner. If you look closely at that Hague case, although it does affect our ability to use proceedings, you'll see that it only held that due process is violated where there is service of process is defective. In that case, the petitioner was declared not to have to prove a meritorious defense because he never there never was affected a proper service on a defendant. As you can see, the case we have here before you is certainly not anywhere near that type of case in the factual situation. In our case, the petitioner in this court was also the petitioner in the trial court. She had the primary responsibility of prosecuting the case. Her attorney, in turn, was served in a false action, which is justified under our rules of civil procedure. And the case got disposed of by default judgment at that case, after that situation. In conclusion, let me just say once again that the requirements under Baker versus Goldsmith, once again, state very plainly that the petition must, with factually and with particularity, state a cause of action, a cause of action being all three elements, not merely the first element. And what we're saying before this court is that both of the lower courts, both the trial court and the court of appeals, saw that even if you give every fact in that bill of review petition, deemed as admitted or deemed in favor of the petition, nevertheless, the state of cause of action, therefore, under the procedure outlined in Baker versus Goldsmith, that the case should have been improperly was dismissed.
Thank you, counsel. Well,
I'm glad Mr. Sanderson brought up the Peralta case. This case came out in February of last year after the Court of Appeals heard oral argument in this case. Peralta case involved a default judgment against on a wrongful death, in which it was true, in fact, in that case, that the person complaining of the default judgment, who eventually brought a bill of review case, had received service, but the service was more than 90 days after the citation had issued. Therefore, under Texas law, at least as interpreted by the U.S. Supreme Court, it was void. The defendant in the fraud case, petitioner on the bill of review, in effect stated that their bill of review was dismissed because they had no defense to the allegations in the original default judgment. They had admittedly had no defense. Not only that, unlike this case here, they had actual notice, even though it was not sufficient to give the apparently to give the Texas court appropriate jurisdiction, at least according to the Court of Appeals that took that case. I believe that was San Antonio Court of Appeals. When the Supreme Court got this case, they basically held, they were talking about notice. They weren't talking about, they were talking about actual notice. It's true that this case could be distinguished because there wasn't valid service. But the court, again and again, the Supreme Court, in its opinion, talks about whether the bill of review petitioner had received notice. And they, in effect, state that under Texas law, this fellow didn't receive notice, even though he had, in fact, been served, even though he had actual notice. Now, our case, our claim, and it's sworn to, and there's nothing in the record on the bill of review hearing to the contrary, is that our client did not receive actual notice. The statement that, well, her attorney, Mrs. Rogers, was served, that gives her some kind of notice. Her attorney was served, and immediately, she hadn't seen this woman for 2-3 years. I don't know what she thought when she never saw her after filing the original petition. She probably thought what most of us think. Well, they've reconciled. This happens. Mrs. Beck had no reason to believe that this case was still alive. For her purposes, she reconciled, probably reconciled more than once with this case. She assumed that Mr. Beck was going to file a new suit. If he had done so, according to what we claim is their agreement, she would have been served. She would have received notice. Mr. Beck had an address at which she could have been served. That's where she got the notice from the clerk that the divorce had been granted. And when Mrs. Rogers filed her motion to withdraw, which stated, I have had no contact with this woman since 1981. To claim that somehow this is constructive notice to Mrs. Beck, when the item incorporating it, the item showing it on the record, states that there wasn't any notice, is stretching the legal fiction just way too far. And that's what Peralta and the case that it primarily relies on, Armstrong v. Manzo. They are talking about actual notice. They are not talking about legal constructs. They are not talking about whether there was or was not service. They are talking about whether this person knew what was going on and had an opportunity to appear and defend themselves. That's what is totally absent here. There's not an iota of actual evidence that was presented at the Baker v. Goldsmith that Ms. Beck knew what was going on. And to say that she was negligent for not knowing about the case that I imagine in some jurisdictions in this state would long since have been dismissed for want of prosecution. She didn't know that case was going to go on forever. She expected Mr. Beck to file a lawsuit. She expected either to get served or for him to somehow or other notify her that something was going to go on. To some extent, she still trusted Mr. Beck.
Was she negligent with regard to Mr. Clark's delay?
Well, Mr. Clark's delay, Your Honor, is he did not, maybe he shouldn't have allowed that order to go to Mr. Jenkins for approval and then submission to the court. It's something that's certainly done all the time for lawyers who are in different towns. Mr. Thorpe was in Austin, Mr. Jenkins was in Bastrop. The letters back that he received from Mr. Jenkins discussed the trial setting. They were writing each other and apparently calling each other back and forth over a period of a month and a half at least, according to Mr. Thorpe's affidavit, as if the motion for new trial was being granted. That's more, it seems to me, Your Honor, a situation where a legitimate mistake has been made. It's quite possible that Mr. Jenkins had forgotten that the order was lying on his desk until after the second or third go-round of trying to fit the trial, which they both were preparing for, into each other's schedules. Mr. Jenkins apparently made the discovery that the motion had been overruled by operation of law, but we've certainly been proceeding under the assumption Mr. Jenkins was acting in good faith and writing these letters, talking to Mr. Stork as if the motion for new trial had been granted. And there doesn't really seem to be much doubt that if it had been presented to Judge Black, he would have signed it. Why else did he, or someone on his behalf, write on the docket sheet, reset to 7/25/89? There wasn't anything to reset to except either a hearing on a motion for a new trial or a new trial itself. Possibly that's negligence. I think it's the kind of question that a trier of fact sitting as such should have been allowed to hear. Now, this case is going on now for not counting the 1981 filing for 5 years. Ms. Beck's run through. Y'all are the fourth court. I hate to say how many judges and lawyers have been involved in this. And all she's asking, we talked about due process, all she's asking for, which she hasn't had yet, is a chance to stand up in public and say why she thinks she ought to have her children safe, which of these people's property is hers or ought to be hers and which should be Mr. Beck's. She hasn't had a chance to do that.
Thank you, Counsel. The cases are submitted on written briefs and oral arguments. That concludes the business of the court, and the marshal will adjourn the court.
Yeah, oh yeah.